Okay, come on up. Next case is number 23-11286, Christy Williams et al. Versus the Board of Trustees of the University of Alabama.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Tyler White for Appellant Board of Trustees of the University of Alabama. The Board appeals an order from the Northern District of Alabama denying its motion to dismiss Family Medical Leave Act claims against it by former employee Christy Williams. And the matter is before this Court on an interlocutory appeal because the Board argued to the District Court that dismissal was proper based on 11th Amendment immunity. And as such, the district court's order is subject to immediate appeal pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 1291. I don't believe there's any dispute in this case that the board is a state entity entitled to the protections of the 11th Amendment immunity, including sovereign immunity from lawsuits for damages based on some federal statutes.
But and certainly a big dispute about whether or not Congress has the power to abrogate the immunity, right?
Depending
on what bucket you're in.
Right. The board recognizes that that's not without exception, of course, for the abrogation argument. The question really before the court today, I think, is whether the type of leave that Mrs. Williams' complaint states she took renders the board immune from her FMLA lawsuit, or whether it's the type of leave that the U.S. Supreme Court has found validly abrogated the state's immunity.
Can I ask you a procedural question?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Generally speaking, when a district court is dealing with subject matter jurisdiction issues at the motion to dismiss stage, it is entitled to pierce the pleadings, do some fact finding, and make determinations of its own. It's not wedded to the complaint. It's not wedded to the answer. It's not wedded to the motion to dismiss. Was it procedurally improper, not substantively wrong, was it procedurally improper for the district court to recharacterize what it thought was the leave that Ms. Williams obtained from the university?
I don't think it was improper for the court to characterize the facts as pled in the way that it did.
But
define
the as pled part sort of fights the hypo, or fights the question. He's asking, like, isn't the court entitled to do some fact-finding of its own without respect to what the pleadings
are? Right. And I don't think the court actually did any fact-finding here, though. I think it just construed the allegations of the complaint the way it construed the allegations of the complaint.
But if, so here's a hypothetical, not this case.
Certainly.
Let's say that Ms. Williams had asked for family medical leave under a provision of the act that she was not entitled to. Okay? Just not entitled to. And somebody at the university, not checking, said, we're going to give you leave under that provision, even though she wasn't entitled to it. But it turns out that she was entitled to family medical leave under another provision. In that scenario, is the district court able to pierce the pleadings and say, what you really got from the university was leave for X and not leave for Y? Procedurally, not substantively.
Correct, Your Honor. I think that's okay.
That's okay. Okay.
That's okay. And I do think that in this case, it's okay that the court ultimately decided, for purposes of construing the motion to dismiss, that the leave that the employee ended up taking was under 29 U.S.C. 2612A3.
Can't you have, I don't understand why this is an either-or question, because can't you, I mean, if you have the right to leave, it doesn't really matter the statutory subsection that it comes under.
Well, it only does because there's been two different U.S. Supreme Court decisions.
No, I'm saying in the matter of the complaint, right? I mean, you're saying I have the right to leave, that leave was denied. It matters for your purposes. I think you might need to rebut all conceivable rights to leave that they allege. But why do you say, like, oh, well, you only allege this particular subsection instead of this other subsection? That seems odd to me.
Right. The reason why it matters is because under 2612A1C of the FMLA, that's leave to care for a spouse, a parent, or a child.
But I guess it strikes me that probably the reason you want to characterize this as a particular kind of leave is because you don't want to be in A1C. That's bad for you because the Supreme Court has said abrogation applies.
That's
correct. You want strategically to be somewhere other than A1C.
I do, Your Honor, but I believe the facts support being under A1.
And this goes back to my point.
A3.
If you have the right to leave, if your allegation, your complaint is I have the right to leave, how are there facts that support, well, you have the right to leave under this one, but not this one, when you would arguably have the right to leave under both?
Certainly. So actually under this provision, or under the military leave provision that we're talking about, 26A3, you actually have to show that you had a, that the employee had a right to leave for a covered service member. And that's exactly what was pled here, as opposed to just a daughter, for example. A daughter.
Yeah, but the service member is a daughter, though.
That's right.
But so that's my point. How can you limit their complaint to just pleading a right to leave under one particular subsection?
Well, under the family care provisions, son or daughter actually has a definition. And they didn't meet the definition of that in the allegations of their complaint. Because the definition, for example, if they're over 18, they have to be incapacitated to qualify under the C provision.
Well, one thing that's tricky about this to me is I view there as being three possibilities: A1C, A1E, and A3.
Correct.
Right? On the merits, I think she may not be entitled to leave under any of them. Like, there may be little, like, sort of problems with each of those theories. But it seems to me, for present purposes in this procedural posture where we're trying to decide this jurisdictional question, this 12B1 question, we've just got to figure out what type of leave she sought, right?
Right, correct.
Not what she qualifies for, but what she sought.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay. And so your contention is what, A3?
My contention is A3.
Is A3, and you think that A3 necessarily stands aside from A1C. It's not a subspecies.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So see, I think anyway, especially by virtue of the wording of the form, I mean, this is a mess because, like, nothing quite matches up. Her allegation in the complaint doesn't quite match up to any of these three buckets. We don't have your email response in the record, so we don't really know what that thing said. But if you look at the form that everybody agrees she filled out,
right,
it's basically a paraphrase chopped up of A3.
Correct.
So I think I sort of agree with you that A3 is the likeliest bucket here. But I'm not sure that A3 can't be a species of A1C. Why is it that it can't be a species of A1C?
Sure.
If I can tag on to that.
Certainly.
In a way that just adds the amount of time.
Yeah, right. It's like a turbocharged version of A1C.
It's like,
military.
Hey, if you have regular family leave, but you get the A3, you're able to extend the period that you otherwise would be entitled to.
Well, I think really I have three responses to that. Number one, just because A3 contains the word family leave is really of no consequence. I mean, Family Medical Leave Act. And just because there's a tie between those two, right? That there's a family leave connection. But beyond that, 2612A1C doesn't contain the words family leave, and calling it the family care provision is just for ease of reference in the briefs. But most importantly, I think what the Coleman case shows, that's cited in our brief, is that there are distinct provisions. And in particular, it's not just the extension of the leave that makes three different. It's the addition of the next of kin as well, because that expands the scope of what can be at issue, because you've got brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, even first cousins if they're next in line.
So is your point here, this is helpful, is your point here that the abrogation analysis in Hibbs with respect to A1C is really about gender and this very robust record that Congress has assembled about discrimination against women by states?
Right.
And your point is
maybe what you're saying is, look, well, okay, fine. Look, if you want to call A3 a species of A1C, that's okay by me. But you've got to do a separate abrogation analysis with respect to A3 claims that come under A1C. You can't just take Hibbs and, like, plunk it down on A3 claims.
That's right. The court must do the same analysis that the Supreme Court has done twice before when two different provisions of the FMLA came before it. And really look at the legislative history to determine why did Congress decide to amend the FMLA and expand these rights here. The other point I'll make, in addition to the next of kin being an addition, is that you have the addition of covered service member, and that has a specific definition that C doesn't have. So it really is more than just giving and 14 more weeks of leave.
So let's just assume that you're right about which subsection this falls under. Could you just address your argument that Congress didn't abrogate that under the war powers?
Right. So there's no indication from the legislative history, and really the key points, I think, are cited in the brief regarding the legislative history of the amendment, which is three. The FMLA was enacted in 93, and the amendment came in 2008. And everything that's being discussed there is about the concern that employees needed substantial leave time, and in some cases to relocate altogether to where the service member was located, which, by the way, is what happened according to the pleading here. She had to move from Alabama to Hawaii to take care of her daughter.
Yeah.
So this difference is material for the purposes of making it a distinguishing provision of the FMLA.
Am I right that this was added in 2008?
2008, yes.
Yeah, in something called the National Defense Authorization Act for the fiscal year?
That's correct, Your
Honor. Okay. I mean, how can you, I guess, in light of that kind of obvious connection to the war powers, it just seems to me like I take it your point that Congress needed to make specific findings on the need to abrogate. I mean, that's your point?
Well, they did when they enacted the FMLA, and they said this one of the big provisions was there's stereotypes about women and how much time they need. There's policies that are being unfairly administered.
Yeah, isn't that because under the 14th Amendment, Congress has to act in a way that's congruent and proportional to the 14th
Correct.
Amendment? Is there any similar obligation under the war powers? I think the answer is no.
I don't think so.
Well, in separate questions, I don't mean to turn this into like a Fed court seminar, but I mean, there's abrogation and then there's waiver, right? I mean, like this, the recent USERRA case out of Texas, and I know you've addressed this very briefly in your brief, but my understanding is that that's not sort of like a core abrogation case. That's the conclusion of the court there, for better or worse, is that the states had waived their immunity by entering into the Constitution in the first place.
Well, I mean, but you have the Coleman case that says
Coleman's an abrogation case, right?
It is an abrogation case.
It's not different from war powers.
Brasher's
asking you a separate question
about
Article 1, Article 2, Article 4, all these war powers things.
Well, I mean, all I can say is that this is, of course, not a USERRA case. I know that goes without saying. But I don't think there's any case law.
It's not a USERRA case. It's a National Defense Reauthorization case. That sounds like really military-ish, right?
It is. I mean, that was the purpose behind the enactment. Or the amendment, rather.
But the question you're getting is whether or not there are, and maybe abrogation is too loose a term, but whether there are ways to make the states comply with certain federal laws that don't depend on 14th Amendment abrogation.
Perhaps, but I have not seen any case law that examines that issue.
Well, the Torres case, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think if you look at Torres versus Texas, the case from the Supreme Court, the USERRA case, there's no congruent and proportional analysis there. It's just a war powers analysis, right?
Right, but that's a USERRA case.
Well,
but okay, I understand that.
I mean, the point being is if this was an Article I war powers exercise of congressional power, I guess the question is, why isn't it that? And if it is that, then you don't have immunity to this lawsuit, right? Under Torres.
Yeah, I would have to.
Why don't you think about it?
Yeah, I'll take my time.
For your rebuttal.
Can I ask you one question just so you can think about this in conjunction with the other? For the National Defense Reauthorization Act, the 2008 legislation that adds A1E and A3, mm-hmm. did Congress state
that it was legislating pursuant to a particular power? And if so, what did it say? And does that, and I guess third, does that matter? Does that bind, does that sort of control us? And it, here's the thing. Don't freak out about this. If you can't figure it out in 10 minutes, we can get supplemental briefing on this. I don't want to like jack up
no,
the
no,
entire
understood.
Time trying to listen.
Thank,
but
thank
those
you,
are three questions that are relevant.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. We'll see you in a little while. Who's going first? Ms. Edwards? Okay. Are you dividing your time in any specific way?
Yes, sir. I'm going to take 7 minutes and my law partner will take eight.
No, I know that. But in terms of substantive issues?
Yes, sir.
Are you treating some and he's treating some of the others?
Yes, sir.
Okay, tell me what that division is.
I'm going to be treating what the board alleges with our complaint along with the district court's inferences, and my law partner will address sovereign immunity and congressional intent.
Okay.
And Torres as well.
So just so I understand, who's in charge of helping me understand which of the three buckets I identified this sort of like complaint goes in?
Me.
Perfect.
Okay. If it'll please the court, good morning. My name is Nicole Edwards, and I'm here for the FLE. As you know, the complaint is the genesis of the action, and it was freely available to attack at any point in time. However, the board raises new issues on appeal. The board contends that Ms. Williams pled facts and admitted into taking active duty leave in her complaint.
So let me ask you this just briefly, and I realize there's going to be some bleed over from buckets to immunity.
Sure.
There just is. But so you, like in the same way they want this to be something other than A1C, so they don't have to tangle with Hibbs, you want A1C because you get the benefit of Hibbs. So are you content with a position that this is really A3, but that A3 is perhaps a species of A1C?
Right. We are with the contention with the court that we do believe it's under A1C. I can
without respect to A3?
No, it could be A3.
I mean, I think,
I'll put all my cards on the table.
I think if you read that form, it's kind of hard to come away with any other view than that this is basically a chopped up, paraphrased version of A3.
We believe it is a subsection of that because it's the care of the family, which is A1C all day, and it's A3 as well. The difference is, I believe that they pled at the motion to dismiss level and at the 11th Circuit level for active duty under A1E, which, by statute and plain language on the statute, requires qualifying exigent circumstances. And that's what the court addressed in its order. And now they're saying, this is my hearing for the first time, that now they want A3. The form that they attached, let me just go back to what they're saying that we pled to in the complaint. The board contends that in two paragraphs of our complaint that we admitted to taking active duty leave, and we contend that we did not. Paragraph 12 is the first one, and it reads, on May 7th, 2020, Williams completed a military family leave absence request form provided by UAB. It is not the employee's position or requirement to ask for what type of leave under these subsections, which we're here trying to figure out. She just asked for leave. The fact that they gave her the form to fill out is on them, and whatever form they gave her, she filled out.
Do you know, I think Judge Jordan's right that we're not sort of technically bound to the pleadings, but she does, in her complaint, use the language of A1E.
Because that is the document that they gave her to fill out.
Oh, so
the language is just the top of the form.
I see.
If you take
it,
the form,
it refers to the exigency language, that form?
Right. No, it didn't. I don't believe
I don't think
on
it
the
does.
Form. They attached it in their brief. I'm not sure if they're trying to get a motion or a summary judgment or a motion to dismiss, but they attached that. Two things to check. And she, I don't know who filled it out, because a lot of times in my cases, the HR person fills it out and the employee signs it.
Yeah, so I guess just a point of curiosity, the form is one thing, and the substance of the form to me is a paraphrase of A3, but she alleges in her complaint On May 20, 2020, UAB approved Williams for MILC Capital, Military Qualifying Exigency Leave.
Based on the form she filled out.
But the form doesn't, I mean, that sound, military qualifying exigency leave sound, that's 21, that's A1E language.
It is.
But I don't think that language is on the form. I might be wrong. And I'm just wondering where that language came from. That's like that's the only indication, so far as I can tell, that this might be an A1E case, is that allegation in the complaint.
In contention that it's an A1E?
E.
Okay. That's based on the form she filled out, and there's a lot of other evidence that we haven't even got to. This isn't even the final form. She was actually got leave all the way to June 22nd of 2020, so this isn't the correct one, and we dispute this evidence that as presented.
The parties were allowed, though not required, they were allowed to present evidence because this went to subject matter jurisdiction through the lens of sovereign 11th Amendment immunity. Did the parties present any evidence, aside from the form, as to what leave she really sought and what leave she was really given? Was there any declaration or affidavit from Ms. Williams? Was there any affidavit or declaration from anybody on the university side?
No, because the court treated this as a motion to dismiss, not as a summary judgment.
Would you agree with your opponent that when you're dealing with subject matter jurisdiction at the motion to dismiss stage, the district court can pierce the pleadings?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so the parties weren't prohibited from doing it. They weren't required to do it, but you're saying nobody did it.
Aside
from the form, there's no evidence aside from the complaint. There's nothing.
No.
Except for the complaint. Okay. Right.
My client went into the HR department and told the story that she had of what happened to her daughter. They gave her the form. She asked for leave and leave only. She has no idea about A1s and all the subsections.
She didn't read the entire federal medical leave?
No, she didn't.
Really? Oh.
Not this time. She has now.
Am I right? I'm not asking you to give anything away for your case down the road if it survives. But am I right in thinking that at this jurisdictional procedural posture, we're really just trying to figure out what kind of leave she sought?
Mm-hmm.
I think there might be problems on the merits for an A1C claim, an A1E claim, or an A3 claim. But for right now, we're just trying to figure out what she sought. Is that right?
That's right. Okay. Well, I don't know if my client had to go in and see what leave she sought. They gave her a form and she filled it out. And we pled it the way the form read. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she just has to give notice that she needs leave and they were to determine what
she claims the entitlement to leave in this action. And her entitlement to leave could come under A1C or A1E or A3 or any of these things, or it could not be there at all, but she claims the entitlement
to leave.
Right, and she's just required to give notice when she found out what happened to her daughter. Right. She came in and gave proper notice, and
so we're not trying to figure out whether she can proceed under A1C, A1E, or A3, whether she might ultimately have trouble under any of those. We're just trying to figure out whether, we have to figure out which bucket we might have to figure out which bucket it's in for abrogation purposes or waiver purposes.
Right.
One possible answer to that question may be a remand for fact-finding by the district court on exactly what happened here.
Go ahead.
Maybe.
Okay, sorry.
What
can you say something?
Well, I was going to ask, and I guess I take it you do this work on a regular basis. Does, as a general matter, one plead a specific subsection of the FMLA when you bring a claim like this?
No, we do not have to say what type of leave she took, just that she qualified for leave, she was an employee, they were an employer, she met all the standards under the FMLA Act, and that she asked for it appropriately if she knew about what something was going to happen, and she did, and if they interfered, you know, it's not... interference. There's no intent behind that. If they interfered whatsoever, I can argue that they interfered by giving her the wrong form. Right. You know, that's a level of interference.
It strikes me. I want your thoughts on this. It strikes me that this question about what subsection this is pleaded under really comes more for when you're trying to establish liability, right? When you're past the complaint portion, and you're at that point, would you have to identify in like a response to a motion for summary judgment or something like that? Here's the section that gives us the entitlement to leave, and this is why we were entitled to it.
Well, I think the board's trying to do that because they're trying to say that the states, you know, have sovereign immunity, and that's why they're trying to do it.
Well, I'm just saying for your perspective, when do you do it? When would you establish this is the section that gives me the right to this leave? Would that be at the summary judgment stage?
It would be, probably, yes.
Is it possible for us to resolve this case by just saying that Hibbs exists and says that there's abrogation of some kind, and we're not necessarily saying whether we're not actually not addressing the validity of the claim at all, mm-hmm. but there is abrogation here, and then you can just go back and litigate in the district court whether they're liable, and if they're liable under that section or another section, and they can raise this immunity issue again once you're actually trying to establish their liability under a particular section.
I think so, Your Honor.
So hold on. I just want to make sure I'm tracking. It seems to me, as is often the case, that the difficulty for us has been created by the Supreme Court in the way that the Supreme Court does this abrogation stuff, right? It hasn't, like, treated the FMLA in gross. Mm-hmm. It's treated family leave under the FMLA, which we're calling an A1C claim in Hibbs, and said, yes, abrogation. But then you've got Coleman deals with some other piece of the FMLA. The Supreme Court says no. And so it's like parsing and slicing and dicing the FMLA. So, I mean, if we're charged with making a threshold jurisdictional determination, I don't know that we can just sort of kick this what piece of the FMLA are we in determination down the road, or whether we have to make it now.
Well, I think you can just look at, if you're looking at what they originally argued, that it was active duty leave, I think you can easily determine that it wasn't that, because there in the regulations it's clear there's 9 subsections of what causes exigency that they need, and it's something that's deployment or anything to do with active duty in the military. If you look at A3, this broadens. I mean, obviously we're trying to take care of our service members. That's what we're trying to do. And in 2008, that is the historical context of what was happening in the country. And if you look at A3, it just broadens it, and it adds next of kin. So if you don't have a spouse or a child, that someone's going to take care of our service member.
Yeah, I think the difficulty is, and now and I recognize, I'm like pushing you into his talk. He's not going to have anything to talk about by the time he gets up here.
I think he will.
Sorry.
But so here's my potential problem with that, is that, as I said, if we're bucketing this action at this juncture, which we may not need to, but if we are, then for my money, this is an A3 case. An A3 might be a species of A1C, but I don't know that that means that you can simply take what the Supreme Court said in Hibbs about gender discrimination by the states as, you know, sort of a congruent and proportional response to that gender discrimination, and then just say, like, oh yeah, and the military too, even when it doesn't really involve, it's not about women at all anymore, at least necessarily. And I mean, I think there, I don't know, it's intuitive to me that the states would be less likely to want to discriminate against military members, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
But I think the difficulty for you might be that then Congress might not have had this robust record about discrimination by states against the military that it could have used to abrogate. Now, you might still have USERRA or a USERRA-esque arguments to make under Torres. But the abrogation piece might be kind of hard for you if you just say this is sort of A3 species of A1C.
But to me, into the district court,
you can respond to that, and then we'll hear from your partner.
To me, it was clear, into the district court, it was clear that if Congress wanted to carve out another A1, it could have with this service member family leave, which they did not. They adopted the same language and then just put service member in front, and broaden the time period from 12 weeks to 26 weeks. So I believe it's an extension. I believe it's clear. I don't believe we have to look to congressional intent, but if we do, I think what's going on in the country in 2008 backs our claims that it falls under the sex discrimination things that were going on, are trying to limit sexual discrimination and gender discrimination. So I believe that it is a part of the family care. I'll sit down on that.
Thank you. Mr. Edwards.
Your Honor, if it may please the court, the court in Torres did not necessarily have to discuss congressional abrogation of immunity under the 14th Amendment, because in Torres, the court held that as part of the plan of the Constitutional Convention, that the states waived their immunity under Congress's Article I power to raise and support armies and provide and maintain a navy. The court then went on to hold in Torres that Congress's power to build and maintain the armed forces fits Penn East's test. Now, what they're referring to there is a case of Penn East Pipeline Company, New Jersey, which was decided a few years prior. And the Penn East test has to do with structural waiver or structural immunity, which says that when the states decided to enter into the plan or the structure of the original Constitution, they agreed to waive immunity to the states when it dealt with the War Powers Clause.
So to Judge Brasher's question, why not this case? Why not the 2008 Defense Reauthorization Act or whatever?
Well, to answer that, this case should deal with that too, because, for example, a question the respondents waived in Torres was, well, this is dealing with USERRA, which wasn't enacted around the time of the plan of the convention.
And the Supreme Court clearly tells them, so what?
No.
Right. They say, so what? The broader picture is the law has to do with maintaining and supporting an army. Torres came back from Iraq, wanted to be a state trooper again, was told you can't do that based on some sort of disability, you know, he received while being deployed. And the court even held that somehow is supporting and maintaining an army.
Is your point that, like, this is just sort of, like, too far afield from supporting and maintaining an army and a navy?
No, your point is this is the same thing.
The same thing that my contention is that any law that has the fingerprints of dealing with maintaining and supporting the armed forces.
Oh, yeah, sorry. See, this is where I get confused when people split their arguments. I'm thinking that you're arguing for his side. Yeah. Right. So
no, Your Honor. That the court's inquiry should stop by deciding that if this does somehow, if the board is correct, which we contend they're not, we contend the district court was correct, if the board's correct that this is somehow covered service member family leave, that since this relates to Congress's ability to support and maintain an army under the War Powers Clause, the state of Alabama has no sovereign immunity.
Could you just play that out? Because I think the other side's argument is something along the lines of this isn't really about protecting veterans. This isn't allowing people to go serve in the military. This is about employees being able to take time off. What's the link between the employees of the state being able to take time off, who are not themselves in the military, and war powers? I think they're making an attenuation argument. So could you address that?
I think the continuation argument
I misunderstood.
I think the argument could be made that setting the military stuff aside, when we're talking about what bucket to put this under, that A1C and A3 all relate to the employee caring for someone other than themselves, a family.
So I think you might be missing Judge Brasher's question. Judge Brasher is asking you to answer the question that I was trying to pose to you as your adversary, which is the too far afield question. He's saying, like, look, okay, so USERRA's like really core war power stuff. Mm-hmm. Is there an argument that this is further afield from Article 1, Article 2 war power stuff. This is not sort of like as core as corely, if that's even a word, military as that was. Without respect to A1C, A3, all that stuff.
I would say that it could be linked to USERRA because USERRA dealt with, in Torres, he was receiving some sort of benefits or leave in relation to the armed services. And in this case, the covered service member leave has to do with raising and supporting an army, caring for covered service members, just like USERRA can in some way care for a veteran or a former covered service member.
So your point is that sort of the war powers rationale applies not only to plaintiffs who themselves are service members, but also to plaintiffs who are next of kin, caring parents, whatever, caring for service members.
Yes, that it could extend also to the family, the covered service member's family.
Yeah, and so how, I guess, in the USERRA case, I understand the Supreme Court's point to be, look, USERRA says states can't fire people who join the military and are required by their military service to serve overseas, right? I get that if states were allowed to do that and Congress couldn't, you know, say those people get to sue them when they do it, that that would undermine military readiness, make it impossible to field an army, right? Is it the same thing here, though? Is saying that a state, you know, like a military's mom, you know, a mom of a military veteran, a military service member, can't leave her job to go take care of that service member? Is that really making it, I mean, when a state does that and says, no, you have to keep working, I'm sorry that your service member son is injured, is that really frustrating Congress's ability to field an army?
I would say so. It could mushroom into, you know, many covered service members, family members, if they're prevented from doing that. I would say that could lead to somehow thwart the federal government to regulate the Army, yes.
I mean, how? I mean, I guess I'm trying to see the connection there between the, you know, the mom or the dad or whatever can't leave their state job and how the military lacks an ability to function.
I would go back again to my point that
you may want to focus on the part of that bucket, for better or for worse, that deals with taking care of an incapacitated family member who's in the military. I mean, that's probably as close as you get.
Yeah, I would agree with that. If a family member is not allowed to take care of their son or daughter that's been incapable of self-care, they're not allowed to take leave, and that service member is not allowed to recuperate, I would say that does interfere with
if mom can get off work to go help daughter recover, daughter gets put back into the field more quickly?
Yes.
Is that the idea?
Yes.
And I would guess that would hold in some cases and not hold in some fact patterns and not in others. I mean, like, does it matter whether the person is active duty or reserve? How likely it? What, you know, did they just come off active duty? Are they scheduled to go back? Does all of that stuff matter if we're talking about fielding an army?
Right. Again, I would say the war powers are so broad that I would say it all relates to the maintaining and supporting of an army, just based on those illustrations you just pointed out.
Okay, Mr. Edwards, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors. Judge Newsom, to try to answer a little bit of the questions that you posed. I don't know whether the National Defense Reauthorization Act whether it's what particular power it's legislating to. I mean, it's thousands of pages long.
Yeah.
It would require some briefing on that. But I will say the questions that are being posed to the appellee here are the right ones, because I think in Torres, the court focused on the complete delegation of authority to the federal government to provide for the common defense here. And really, for waiver to apply, there has to be compelling evidence that the founders thought that such a surrender was inherited in the constitutional impact of that. And so here, I think just the fact that the questions are being asked, these are people that are being given leave through the military caregiver provisions that are not themselves members of the military, I think just that question alone shows that there's not compelling evidence that the founders thought that a complete surrender of that power to the federal government to provide leave to non-military members should be in place. And I think, you know, to further that point, that it's not exclusively delegated to the federal government to regulate non-military leave or non-military member leave, is the fact that there's several states that have enacted military caregiver leave as well, which we cited in our brief.
Do you think we should be deciding all these questions on this barren record? I mean, nobody put in any evidence aside from the form. We don't know what the discussions were in detail between Ms. Williams and the people in HR. We don't know what HR told her. We don't know whether they sent her the wrong form, whether that was the intended form. We don't know what they ultimately granted. I mean, we're dealing with a lot of abstract constitutional abrogation and war powers questions on an incredibly barren record at the motion to dismiss stage.
I agree with you that the record is pretty barren, but the record that we do have reflects to me that this is an A3 case.
So you think, if okay, let me ask you this question.
Sure.
It may be unfair. If it's A3 and we conclude, because you're asking us to decide that issue on this record, and we conclude that Congress properly abrogated for A3 purposes, is that a death knell for you on liability in this case?
Meaning if you determine that it falls
you're claiming it's A3, right?
Right.
If we conclude, okay, it's an A3 claim, but Congress properly abrogated under A3, is that a death knell for you on liability in the case? Because, boy, the allegations of this complaint scream of interference.
Oh, you mean factually?
Yes.
No, Your Honor. Of course, I wouldn't concede death knell for losing the case if we have to litigate the case.
Ooh, it doesn't look good for you, though.
I understand.
And the same thing that happened in the previous case, when you push in one bucket, it may help you on abrogation and immunity. It hurts you on the merits, and the same, you know, boomerang effect for them. Tell me how she's eligible for A3 leave. What exact provision of the regulation did she satisfy?
Certainly, Your Honor.
The district court didn't think that she could have satisfied A3 leave because she didn't meet any of the requirements of the reg. So tell me which provision of the regulation she satisfied to get A3 leave.
Well, in A3 leave, all that's required is the need for leave due to the covered service member's inability to or incapacitation.
Okay. And what is there in the record that says she was incapacitated on this barren record?
Well,
because sexual assault and rape is a horrible, horrible thing, but people, victims react in different ways, right? And so we have no idea from this record whether or not the child, the daughter, was incapacitated.
But I think to Judge Newsom's point that he made earlier, we don't have to know whether she was capacitated. It's about what did she request? What was requested?
No.
What type
You're
of
giving her the
requested?
Leave. You're giving her the leave. You have to be satisfied that she has met
the FMLA requirements. And I'm asking you what subsection of the regulation Ms. Williams satisfied to get A3 leave.
Well, again, I would just...
Because if she could not have satisfied A3 leave, how can you claim that it's A3 despite the form you gave her, despite the form she signed, despite what's pled in the complaint?
Many times employers do give leave despite employees not actually meeting the requirements of a particular provision just by virtue of giving that leave.
So this is a claim against you where she says she is entitled to something and you say she's not entitled to it. So the question is not, you know, whether she was entitled to it or under what section she was entitled to it. The question is what her claim is, right?
It's about what she requested, what her claim is. What, why is she seeking leave?
Yeah, that's, but I mean, I guess though, you say it's about what she requested. I think I generally agree with you, but it, to me, it's not what she requested at the time. It's what she's requesting in this lawsuit, right? She claims that she was entitled to something in this lawsuit, and the question of these subsections is, what's the subsection the claim in this lawsuit
right.
is under, right?
Right, as pled. I mean, certainly that is the crux of, you have to take the complaint as it lies, assume the truthfulness of the complaint for purposes of a motion to dismiss, given your points as well, Judge Jordan, about expanding the factual record. But this is subject matter jurisdiction. I think one of you said earlier, this is not something that can just be punted and let's decide after we've litigated the entire case. I do think that subject matter jurisdiction is not waivable, and it is something that the court needs to decide from the outset rather than litigating the entire case and then deciding whether immunity applies.
Okay. Thank you both very much. All three of you very much.